Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Thursday, dear listeners. You are listening to the voice of the king of DC media, William Powell, a.k.a. the man who is large and in charge. I welcome you to the 43rd episode of Inside Acting. We are coming up on a year on the air, January 6th, and it has been a blast. Tonight I have on a man I've admired and followed for some time, director, producer, and writer Kenneth Johnson, the creator of the miniseries V, also the writer on such shows as Adam 12, The $6 Million Man, The Bionic Woman, The Incredible Hulk, Alien Nation. I mean, if you are a science fiction geek, get ready for a great show. And I'm going to bring Mr. Johnson in right now. And it'll take a few seconds here. Hey, Mr. Johnson, thank you so much for joining me.
Will, for starters, it's Kenny. It's always been Kenny to all my family and friends, and that should certainly include you and your listeners.
Oh, okay. That's good. All right.
Yeah, I was a junior. My father's name was also Kenneth Johnson. So I'm Kenneth Johnson, and my mother liked seeing the credit look like that on the screen. But everybody from my family on up, and all of my crew and cast, and all of my dear friends, everybody calls me Kenny.
Okay, Kenny. All right, man. Let's dive right into the movie. How's that coming along?
It's getting closer every day. It's a real challenge. When I discovered that I solely owned the motion picture rights about a year and a half ago, I suddenly had a lot of new best friends in Hollywood, and virtually all the studios came after me to sell them the rights. and for an obscene amount of money, and literally I had meetings all over town at Universal, Fox, MGM, United Artists, Paramount, you name it, Disney, we were there, you know, Warner Bros.
Uh-huh.
But I really had concerns about losing creative control, or at least having it eroded if I did it through the studio system. And so I said, well, thanks very much. The overtures you have made are lovely, but no. And the odd thing, Will, is when you say no in Hollywood to a studio, they think it's because you want more money. And I had to explain sort of patiently, no, guys, that's not what it's about. What it's about is protecting the essence of what I created. Because, you know, I created The Bionic Woman and then created the television version, the series of Incredible Hulk. And I watched as both of those projects were reimagined by other people and were very unsuccessful for the most part. That's putting it mildly and politely, but it's funny because they thought when The Bionic Woman was coming back on, they do a thing out here in California and Hollywood and in the film business and television industry called tracking. They track a show before it goes on the air to see what the buzz is about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that before The Bionic Woman went on the air, that it was the highest tracking news series in the history of Western civilization or something.
Wow.
Right? And I said, yeah, but have you seen the pilot? And they said, no, but it's tracking off the charts. It's going to be a humongous hit. And, you know, they spent $8 or $9 million on advertising and billboards and all this sort of stuff. And I said, yeah, but have you seen the pilot? And he said, no, but it doesn't. I said, listen, I've seen the pilot. And it's not going to work because and it's interesting because David Icke is a very talented writer, producer, director, and he had done a wonderful job in reinventing Battlestar Galactica. I think the new one he did was much, much better than the old one ever was. And when I heard he was doing The Bionic Woman, I thought, well, you know, that could go. I mean, he could make it work. No, because I saw the pilot and they had just like totally missed the whole essence of what it was about. There was no heart, there was no humanity, there was no humor. It was just really dark and not what the audience was expecting. And although they tuned in big for the first night, the second week it was on the air, the third of their audience went away, and the whole show went away after only like 7 or 8 weeks on the air. It just crashed and burned. And I got to say, to David Icke's credit, and I will always respect him for this, he stood up afterwards and says, you know, we blew it. He said, he said in several interviews, we never knew what the show was about or how to do it. It didn't have any heart. It was like, it was perfect, you know. He really took it on the chin and took responsibility. And the same thing really happened with the motion picture versions of the Hulk. Gail Ann Hurd, who, of course, is a brilliant motion picture producer, goes back to Terminator with her then-husband, Jim Cameron, and, and just a slew of great television, great motion pictures, had worked for, I think, close to a dozen years with about 10 different writers trying to get a script for The Incredible Hulk that worked, and then they finally brought Ang Lee on to direct, who is a, you know, an incredibly respected director. I think he's a terrific director, but I think that's sort of odd casting, you know, for The Incredible Hulk. But, hey, you know, maybe he'll bring a level of class to it like he did to Crouching Tiger and Brokeback Mountain and that sort of thing. But the movie was just, we were at the premiere, my wife Susie and I, and it was just so awful that we couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And it's funny because after the premiere, and the only line that the audience reacted to at all, after all those writers and everything, was the one that I wrote back in, you know, 35 years ago, don't make me angry, you wouldn't like me when I'm angry, you know?
Right.
And after the premiere, one of my friends from the studio came up to me and said, Mr. Johnson, don't make me Ang Lee. You wouldn't like me when I'm Ang Lee. The movie opened big, but it was gone the next week because everybody came expecting to see not what we had done, of course, in the 70s and 80s with the Hulk, but the feeling, the humanity, the compassion, the sense of character, and the depth of psychological feelings and all, you know. And instead, they got Shrek. You know, it was
wow. Oh no.
I don't say that lightly, actually, Will, because the problem, I think, with the movies is that you can't take a comic, big CGI comic creature like that and put it in the real world and make it work. You wouldn't put a real human being into a Shrek movie, you know, because your mind would go, wait a minute, this is wrong. It's just a disconnect. It
doesn't look right.
Exactly, it doesn't look right, and so that's part of the problem. And I mean, Joss Whedon did a wonderful job in Avengers of making it work. Partly because, of course, the Hulk only appeared twice in the movie. You know, he only made two appearances, and it was really wonderfully done when he did it. I mean, clearly he was a CGI character, but it was handled with so much more of a sense of character and the Banner character. The only thing that really bummed out me and so many people who have talked to me about it, apparently I get lots of emails about it, and is the fact that he's trying so hard not to get angry all the way through, and then, oh, well, I can turn into the Hulk if I want to, I just have to let it go. And it's like, oh, wait, hold it. You know, that goes against everything we had ever been established from Stan Lee on up about the creature. But I had seen the Bionic Woman get remade by other people and trashed, and the Hulk try to be made by other people not once but twice and really die a terrible death at the box office and with the critics, I was just so fearful of losing creative control to the studios if I signed over the rights to them, that I said, no, I want to really try to do it as an independent picture. And that's a big challenge because, you know, to make this picture right, it's going to cost about $60 million.
Which
is very expensive for an independent picture. I mean, pictures, you know, people think of $10 or $12 million. Actually, most independent pictures now are coming to like 25 and maybe 30. But 60 is a, you know, big piece of change. And so what we've been trying to do is find the right situation and the right equity partner to come aboard with us, and we've been close several times. The problem with being an independent producer, a director, is that you have to kiss a lot of frogs, you know.
That's life.
It's true. Well, you got to kiss so many frogs before you find your prince, right? And it's the same with independent financing. You talk to people who say, "Oh yeah, I've got all the money in the world, and we love this project, and we're ready to go." And then you'd hang on one second. What? No. Yes. And then suddenly we just couldn't find people that we felt were reliable enough yet. But that seems to have changed in the last couple of weeks. But I don't like to talk about anything until it's real. I hate to get the fans all hyped up and then have them be disappointed. I'd rather suffer that disappointment myself until we get to the moment that I can say, okay, it's a done deal, the money's in the bank, and we're going. And even then, people say, well, once the money's in the bank, you believe it, right?
Right. Hey, believe it when you see it.
Well, my feeling is this, well, is it true, and I've always said this, the day that I get to the set and the trucks are all around me on the street, you know, and then I have my assistant director hands me my breakfast burrito in my hand, you know.
Uh-huh.
I stand there and I look around and I allow myself at that point to say, this might really happen.
Then you'll believe it.
But we're in a very positive position. I have a couple of great producing partners who've done a number of independent pictures, and which is a different world for me because, see, I've always been sort of a dependent producer. Most everything that I've ever done has been directly for a major studio or a major network with
right.
a studio partner. And the indie prod world, as we call it, is a whole different animal. And fortunately, I've got these two guys, John Hermanson and Mars Callahan, who have done some stuff and quite a bit of stuff in the independent world, who are so smart it's scary. And we're sneaking up on it, I think. But you'll be the first to know. It'll be posted on my website as soon as it finally breaks. But there is good reason for all of our friends out there who love V as much as I do to hold good thoughts.
So, Kenny, take me back to circa 1981, 1982. What inspired you to write V?
It's interesting. I read a lot, Will. I've never watched much television. I like movies, and I've always loved the movies, and that's always really what I sort of wanted to focus on. Not because it was a big screen as opposed to a smaller TV screen, but because of the theatrical experience of a motion picture. And by that I mean literally the theater full of people. I got into this business interested in the theater when I was in eighth grade and in junior high, and I just knew from by the time I was a tenth grader that this is where I wanted to be. I wanted to be in the theater. I loved that, and I had always intended to be in the live theater. But when I started, when I got into Carnegie Mellon University, which was at the time the most prestigious drama school in the country, and it was only theater. There was no film or television at Carnegie. It was just working with the actors on the boards and learning Stanislavski and all of that. And it was great because I got a tremendous amount of theatrical training working with actors. But at the same time, while I was at Carnegie, I ran a film society, something I just fell into. I befriended a senior who was about to leave, and he trained me to take it over for him. His name was Bill Pence, and Bill went on to create the Telluride Film Festival, which is still running for the 35th or 36th year now in Colorado every Labor Day. He also does the Turner Classic Film Festival out here in L.A. now. It's been going for the last 3 or 4 years in April. And Bill really exposed me to movies that I had never seen before from all over the world. So by the time I got out of Carnegie, I was really steeped in not only the experience of the drama department in the theater and working with actors and all, but also I'd had this kind of cinema tech training that people like François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard were getting at the Paris Cinematheque. It was great. And I realized that I really wanted to make movies because that way I could have a bigger proscenium it's funny, I was walking with my daughter, Julie, when she was at the NYU Film School. I was back visiting her, and we were walking through Times Square one night. And we stopped, and she just looked around and said, "God, Dad, look at all the extras." you know, and she was talking about, of course, the, you know, the thousands of people moving back and forth. But she's, Julie was right in that it was when you're in film, the world becomes your set and your stage, and all the men and women are merely players, as Shakespeare would say. But to come to your question full circle, I read a lot, and I had become a big fan of the American novelist Sinclair Lewis, who wrote Main Street, and who wrote Elmer Gantry, and a lot of very successful novels. But one of his lesser-known novels really intrigued me. It was called It Can't Happen Here. And it was written in, he wrote it in the 1930s, about the rise of fascism that was going on in Italy and Germany at the time, with the idea of, well, we're in America and it can't happen here, you know. And then, of course, in the course of the story, it does. And suddenly we're living in a different country, you know. And I thought, wow, that would be really, really cool to do a piece about a major sea change in our life. And now, remember, of course, this was well before 9/11 and that terrible tragedy. But in the life of people in America, it had been a couple of generations since Pearl Harbor, which was a sea change, where suddenly we were living in a different world and we had to react to it. So I wrote a speculative screenplay about a sort of grassroots fascist takeover of the United States, where it sort of started like a good thing, and then suddenly it wasn't a good thing anymore. And my friend Brandon Tartikoff was the president of NBC at the time, and we were having dinner one night, and he asked what I was thinking about, and I said, well, you know, I've got this thing going. So I love to read it, Kenny. And I said, no, Brandon, this is a feature, Brandon. This is a big time movie. It's not television, you know. And he said, oh, come on, let me read it. So he read it, and he flipped out for it, and he said, look, I love this. This is great. America Under Occupation is a great premise. He said, but I'd love to do it as a big mini series and then maybe carry it on into a series. And he said, but I'm not sure Americans will really understand fascism, you know. And I said, well, it's not really a complicated concept. You know, you put on a black shirt, you shave your head, and you beat somebody up. But Brandon thought we should have an outside force like the Chinese or in those days, the Soviets.
Right.
And I just didn't believe that they could sustain a long-lasting occupation of the U.S. And then I think it was Jeff Sagansky, who was one of Brandon's vice presidents at the time, who said, hey, how about aliens, Kenny? And I went, ah! Because, you know, I had been trained, Will, in the classical theater. I had been trained watching all these classic movies, and I had visions of myself of having a career, you know, like Robert Wise or somebody who's had all kinds of different pictures and all kinds of different genres. But and I always warn my directing and writing students, be very careful of what your first success is, because that's what they'll want you to keep doing, you know?
Absolutely.
And when I Steve Bochco, who was at Carnegie with me, had already gotten a gig as a writer at Universal, and when I came to California, Steve introduced me around and got me hooked in at Universal, and was really pivotal in helping me get to meet Harve Bennett, who was doing the $6 Million Man, and Harve asked me he read a spec script that I had written and asked me if I'd come and give him some ideas for the $6 Million Man, and in the course of our conversation I brought up the Bride of Frankenstein. And I said, you know, you got this monster man, shouldn't he have a female counterpart, you know, an Elsa Lanchester, you know, and that's where the Bionic Woman came from. So I wrote the Bionic Woman very quickly, only a couple of weeks, and Harve asked me to join the $6 Million Man as producer, and I said, no, Harve, you know, let me just write and direct. Producing is a pain in the ass. I didn't even really think of myself as a writer, Will. I was really always a director, first and foremost, but Bochco kept leaning on me to write. And Harve said, listen, Kenny, let me explain it to you. In television, the producer is the guy that's responsible for the whole thing. The producer hires the writer. The producer hires the director. I said, stop, Harve. I'll take the job. And so I did, and I proceeded to hire myself to write and direct. But after The Bionic Woman, of course, then Universal came at me and said, we've just acquired the rights to the Marvel Comics superheroes, five of them. Which one would you like to do? And I said, gee, this was Frank Price running Universal. I said, gee, Frank, none of them, thanks. I just don't deal well with spandex and primary colors, you know? But my wife, Susie, probably the most literate person I know, had given me one of her favorite novels to read, and it was Les Miserables by Victor Hugo. And I was deeply into the novel at that point, and so I had the Jean Valjean and the fugitive concept and the intrepid Inspector Javert pursuing the fugitive. And I thought, well, you know, maybe there's a way to take a little bit of Victor Hugo and a little bit of Robert Louis Stevenson and his Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and this ludicrous thing called The Incredible Hulk and turn it into a really adult, psychological, Greek tragic drama, you know. And I went back to Universal and said, look, I'll do the Hulk for you, but I want something in return. And first of all, I'll do the Hulk, but it's got to be done my way, and it's got to be me doing the casting. I don't want some actor shoved down my throat that's the wrong person.
Right.
And I was lucky enough to get the one and only guy I ever sent the script to, which was Bill Bixby, who was just phenomenal in the role. And but I said, look, I want something in return. I said, I'll do the Hulk, and he said, what would you like to do, Ken? We'll give you something. That makes sense. We'll do a little bargain here. And I said, well, I don't think Sir Walter Scott's 1800s novel of Ivanhoe has ever been done well. It's a great, wonderful, swashbuckling knighthood. Robin Hood is one of the principal characters in it. It's really a terrific story that had never been done. And I said, I'd like to do at least like a 4-hour miniseries of Ivanhoe, and I'll do that. If I do the Hulk, you'll let me do that. And they said, that's great. We shook hands on it, and I wrote the Incredible Hulk pilot in about 7 days. And we shot it, and it became this, you know, a big hit show. It was also released overseas as a theatrical motion picture, became the top grossing movie in Europe for like 2 months. I'm going, what? You know? And but ask me, Will, if Ivanhoe ever got made.
So, I don't think so.
Because when it came time to do it, Frank Price had moved on, and the hand that I shook to make the deal was not the hand that was there to write the check when I needed it, you know.
Oh,
but so,
man.
So I had done The Bionic Woman and The Incredible Hulk, and the idea of adding aliens to my really deeply dramatic story about an occupation of the United States. At first I thought, oh God, I just don't want to go into alien stuff. But then I thought about it and I thought, wow, you know, the story that I'm telling here is not about aliens or big spaceships or anything like that. It's about power. It's about people who are in power and abusing it. It's about other people who suck up to that power for their own personal gain, like the Vichy French did in World War II.
Right.
Or the people who keep their heads down and say, well, if I just keep my head down and don't bother them, maybe they won't bother me. And ultimately, it's about the people who say, no, wait a minute, this is wrong, and we have to fight back against it. And they become the heroes of the resistance. And it's a timeless story. It's Spartacus and the revolt of the slaves. It's the American Revolution. It's the fight of apartheid, fighting back against a totalitarian regime. And so I realized that I could still tell that story that I wanted to tell and do all the character exploration that I wanted to do, but I'd get the extra added benefit of having a lot of really dazzling visual stuff with the sci-fi elements of it that would draw in a larger audience than I might have gotten otherwise, and it certainly did. I mean, it was a humongous hit, the number one show in America, that 80 million people in North America tuned in. The critics just went crazy for it, and then when they released it the following year in 1984 around the world, okay, we were up against the 1984 Olympics, right? Well,
yeah,
we beat the Olympics 2-1 in the ratings around the world. You know?
I didn't know that.
It's humongous. It's just gigantic, and because it is a timeless story, it's one that never grows old, and in spite of all the critical acclaim, in spite of the huge popularity worldwide, the one person that wasn't happy with the way that V looked in 1983
uh-huh.
was me, because I hadn't had the time or the money or, most importantly, the tools to do it the way that I needed to do it. You know, the visual effects tools were in their infancy in those days, and special effects makeup was, you know, rubber masks and with air blown into them. You know, and
right.
and I was working with the same guys that that Steven and Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were working with. We were all working at the state of the art, but the state of the art just wasn't where I needed it to be for my vision. And
yeah, matte paintings.
Oh yeah, all that stuff, and now the art is there. I mean, a quick example: there are a couple of shots in V, the special
uh-huh.
effects shots, spaceships flying and stuff, that run about 20 seconds. Will that cost about $75,000 for those 20 seconds? You could do the same shot today on your cell phone, and it would look better. And I'm
oh,
not kidding.
Oh my God.
It's really true, and so the idea of bringing the movie to the big screen and not reimagining it, not coming up with a whole new take on it or something like that, but sticking very close to the story, the storylines, the characters that I initially created that the audience just loved so much, and obviously still bringing it up into the 21st century so that it lives and breathes in today's world. That's become a very, very exciting prospect for me, and the screenplay that I have written, I'm really feel will not only satisfy the audiences who remember it from 30 years ago, but it'll exceed their expectations, and also it will lead us into the fact that it's the first of a trilogy, because I've written since a novel called V, The Second Generation, which picks up the story 20 years later, so we see what's become of the characters that we met, what's become of the world. And
yeah, I love that.
It's a pretty cool concept. So V the movie will just be the first of a trilogy, and it sets up the other two and where we're going. And the thought of being able to take my to revisit my epic and do it the way I always wanted to see it, but take it beyond that now and carry the story on to the conclusion that I always envisioned for it, is really so exciting. I can't tell you, you know.
Yeah, it was quite a hit. And back then, you know, there wasn't but three or four channels. You didn't have a million channels. And I remember growing up, the whole family was watching it. It was quite a story. And I also must confess, when I was in elementary school in the 70s, man, that Bigfoot storyline on the $6 million
man.
That was the talk of the town. How did that come about, man?
Well, it was Bigfoot was big, and it still is. But in those days, for some reason, it was really particularly big. And I realized it would make a great subject. And because I was always looking for worthy adversaries for my bionic man to be up against. And I realized, oh, well, listen, I've got to be Bigfoot. And then I thought, well, what can I do that'll make Bigfoot something other than, you know? And then I thought, well, suppose they get into a fight and Lee pulls his arm off, and instead of blood spurting out, it's a flurry of sparks. My wife, Susie, incidentally, is absolutely convinced that it's impossible for me to write a script that doesn't have that phrase, a flurry of sparks, in it somewhere. You know, she said, if you ever get Ivanhoe done, I know in the script there's going to be somewhere a flurry of sparks.
If
I do a drawing room comedy from the 1800s, you know, somewhere there'll be a flurry of sparks. And I thought, well, how could that be? And then it sort of developed from there, and it got to be great fun. And recently, for the DVD release of the $6 Million Man series, I went back and did a commentary. I didn't direct the show, but it was the only one I think that I've ever done a commentary on that I wasn't actually the director for. But I was on the set a whole lot, and of course producing it, so the buck did stop with me. But it's funny, when people talk about the $6 Million Man to me, the two shows that they always seem to single out as their favorites were The Secret of Bigfoot and The Bionic Woman. And the great thing about Universal in those days for me was it was like graduate school with pay, Will. Steve Bochco and Steve Cannell and Don Balisario, who later went on to create JAG and Quantum Leap and all of those things.
Those are big names.
Yeah, we were sort of the class of 1980 at Universal Studios.
Wow.
And it was a great time to be there, and a very, very creative place. And Harv Bennett, when I first came to work with him on $6 Million Man, he said, you know, Kenny, because I told him, look, I really want to make movies, Harv. And he said, listen, Kenny, doing episodic television, one-hour episodic television, is the greatest training in the world for making movies, or for waging war, for that matter.
Wow.
So that's what we did. And, I mean, that's where Steven Spielberg came from. He directed episodes all over Universal, and then they gave him Duel to do, and he did so well turning a truck into bringing it to life that they gave him a shark to bring to life, and that was that, you know.
Yeah, the rest is history.
That's right. You could say that, and well deserved too. I'm looking forward to seeing Lincoln. It looks to be just brilliant.
I can't wait to see it. So, how did Alien Nation come about?
Alien Nation came about because a friend of mine named Harris Cattleman was running 20th Century Fox Television, and they had a motion picture they had made that Gail Ann Hurd had produced, actually, called Alien Nation. And it was about this a very interesting premise. They said, look, we've got this movie. I hadn't seen it. We got this great – this movie's not doing so very well at the box office. Wasn't reviewed that well, but we think it might be worth a TV series. Would you come and take a look at it? And I said, sure, Harris. You called the Alien guy, right? You know, Kenny. And because by then, you know, I was pretty well pigeonholed as science fiction being what I do. And but out of friendship to Harris, I said, okay, look, I'll come and take a look at it. So I sat in the screening room at Fox, and I'm watching this movie that is sort of like Miami Vice with Coneheads, you know. But it was an interesting premise about a ship that crashes in the Mojave with 250,000 slaves that are alien slaves, and they're stronger than we are, and they've got two hearts and this and that, and one of them has worked his way up to being a detective on the LAPD, and he's got a human partner, and it's a buddy comedy, well, a buddy dramedy kind of thing, right?
Uh-huh.
But the movie itself was just sort of a boring, druggy kind of movie with a little patina of the sci-fi over it, and it wasn't really very interesting. But then there was one scene where the human cop picked up the alien guy at his house, and the alien cop waved goodbye to his family, and there was one shot of his family, Will, standing in the doorway of their little house, a little alien lady and two little alien kids, and the bell went off in my head, and I said, oh, wait a minute, who are they? What's it like to be them? What's it like to be living in a ghetto? What's it like to be the lowest one on the totem pole, the newest minority in the world, you know? And and I went back to Harris Cattleman and the other guys at Fox, and I said, okay, you think you've got Lethal Weapon with aliens, right? And they get, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I
uh-huh.
said, no, let me tell you what you've got. What you've got is In the Heat of the Night. I said, let me do a piece that is about intolerance, that is about prejudice, that is about discrimination, that is about what it's like to be different, and the newest minority. And
interesting.
I said, I can do a show that will have legs and that could go on and on and on. And they sort of got it, and at least well enough to say, yeah, okay, go try that. And they loved what I did, and it's funny. While I was doing the show on the Fox lot, I ran into Conrad Buff, who was had been my film editor on Short Circuit 2. And he was then working with Jim Cameron. He was editing Abyss for Jim on the Fox lot. And so I ran into Conrad. He said, hey, I just got to meet Jim. You want to say hello? And I said, sure. So I went, sat down with Jim Cameron, and he asked what I was doing. When he heard it was Alien Nation, he got this funny look on his face. And he said, well, what's your take on it? And I told him. I said, I'm doing a story about intolerance, about prejudice, about it's In the Heat of the Night, basically. And he laughed, and he said, that's so interesting. He said, that's the way I wanted to go with it. And I said, I didn't know you were involved with it. And he said, well, yeah. He said, Gail asked me to do a draft of the script. This was after they were divorced, but they remained good friends. And he had done a draft of the feature motion picture that was much more in line with what I had been thinking and what I had actually just done. And he said, but when they went another direction, he asked that his name be taken off the project, because he just thought it was all wrong, and he thought my way sounded exactly like what he would have done. So I took that as a harbinger of success, and indeed it was. It was amazing. Will, I did the 2-hour movie pilot, which became a series. It was only on for one season because Barry Diller thought he could get bigger numbers with comedies, which totally failed. And the next year, Peter Chernin, who was then running Fox TV, stood up in front of the Television Critics Association and publicly apologized for canceling Alien Nation. He said it was the biggest mistake we ever made. And so I was on the phone that afternoon going, "So, Peter?" You know. And it took me about 2 years of knocking on the door and pounding on it until they finally said, okay, we'll let you make an Alien Nation movie that follow up and see what happens. It was the highest rated Fox movie they had ever made. And so suddenly they were inspired to buy 4 more, and we were like kids in a candy store. It was so exciting because everybody that was working on the show, all the actors, all the crew people, loved it so much and were so crushed when the show was canceled after only one season to now be able to get back together and do 5 more TV movies, all of which I got to direct because I wasn't busy being the executive producer of a series. You don't have time to breathe when you're doing that. But it was a gift from the gods for all of us. And the biggest delight was not only was it popular with the audiences around the world, but we never got a bad review. I mean, literally all of the reviewers just loved what we were doing, and it was so rewarding to have them recognize the fact that the show had some substance and some depth to it. And I think probably, Will, the fact that I have had such a good success doing the sci-fi stuff that I have done, and indeed I've done some other things too, but is because I've always tried to invest the projects with a layer of sophistication, of subtlety, of character relationships and character depth, and it comes from my theatrical training of, you know, of all the classic theater that I studied and everything. So I think that although I would like to have done more musicals and a couple of cowboy things, you know, I can't complain, and I think that's the reason, certainly the reason that V was as successful as it was, because it gave me an opportunity to do a piece with a spectrum of characters that range from the very good to the very bad, and everything in between, and explore how ordinary people react differently in extraordinary circumstances, and to be able to carry that forward into the new movie version of it is just tremendously exciting.
Yeah, you bring a lot of humanity to your pieces. We've got about 3 minutes left, and I wanted to get into your approach to casting, and I don't think we have a whole lot of time to go deep into that, but you can talk very briefly about that, and then go ahead and plug your website or whatever else you want
well,
to plug, and then we'll
my website is just kennethjohnson.us. KennethJohnson.us, or you can people Google me, and the name comes up pretty quickly right there too. And everybody's welcome. There's also a link on there where people can write to me, which I put on the DVD release when I did the director commentary of V originally. If you got comments or questions, you know, write me and beware what you wish for, Will. You know, it's great.
I remember that.
Thousands and thousands of people from all over the world. It's terrific. But no, I have tremendous respect for actors and tremendous sympathy for the terrible lives that they have to lead when they come into a room. It started at Universal when I was doing casting sessions. I mean, I always had an affinity for actors because a lot of film directors don't have, because of my theatrical training. Because at Carnegie, if you wanted to be a director, you had to take all of the acting classes that the actors did. You had to be on stage yourself and see what it was like and what you needed and how you developed the character and all of that.
Right.
So when I looked at an actor's resume in the casting sessions, the first thing I'd look for is, where did they train? Where did they study? Did they go to Carnegie? Did they go to NYU? Did they go to Northwestern, you know, or Juilliard in later years? And so that's always been very, very important to me. And then the next thing is, in the casting sessions, I read with the actors myself. I don't let somebody else read with them because I like to sit right there and look in their eyes. And also, having been a little bit of an actor, I can often give them a better performance for them to react to. Off of, you know?
Right.
And but the most important thing I try to do is to make them comfortable, and not only for the actors but for everybody that works with me on the set, because I always believe that if people are comfortable and relaxed, then they absolutely feel free to do their very best work, to take a wild shot at something, and if it goes terribly wrong, they're not embarrassed. I say, oh, okay, well, that didn't work. Let's try something else, you know. And because to me, the actors are the linchpin to the whole thing, because of, in spite of all of us working so hard behind the scenes and the tremendously talented crew people that I've worked with, it's those folks who have their faces up there on the screen that really have to take the heat. And so I try to make it as pleasant and happy and creative a situation for them as I possibly can.
Kenny, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I had a blast. You took me back down memory lane. It was fantastic.
My pleasure, Will. I'll be here, and I'll be happy to come back as soon as we get the movie off and rolling, and then we'll talk some more about it.
Man, that sounds like a plan.
Okay, terrific. Thanks a lot.
Oh, okay. Good night.
Good night.
And I'd like to say to all my listeners out there that what you do today can improve all your tomorrows. Good night, everybody.